crimes against the Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. It stressed that weapons of the resistance cannot be touched as long as the Israeli occupation of Palestine continues. Hamas also slammed Abbas' assertion that the movement will have no role in any future Palestinian government. It said the remarks violate Palestinian people's right to self-determination and represent an unacceptable submission to external dictates and projects. Hamas said the only way to protect the Palestinian cause and confronting the fascist Israeli regime's projects is national unity and continued resistance against the occupation. Political commentator Robert Fantina says if Hamas gave up its weapons, it would mean the annihilation of all Palestinian people.
The idea that Mahmoud Abbas, who is nothing but a traitor to the Palestinian people, wants Hamas to disarm is completely ludicrous. Hamas is the only organization that has done anything for the people in Gaza in the last 15 years or so. The Palestinian Authority has done nothing, has only attempted to thwart the work of Hamas as it was working for the people of the Gaza Strip. So the idea that Hamas will give up its weapons when those are a major tool in its resistance is just completely unreasonable. Israel stands ready to annihilate Palestine, to kill all the Palestinians, and will do so. It's in the process of doing so and has been for the last 2 years. Abbas knows this, as everyone in the world knows it, that without the weapons that Hamas has, they have no defense against a very powerful enemy, Israel, which is backed by another powerful enemy, the United States. So suggesting that Hamas has to surrender its weapons, which will mean just the death of all the Palestinians throughout the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, makes no sense whatsoever.
Gaza City remains the main target of Israel's latest strikes on the Gaza Strip as the regime presses ahead with its genocidal war across the besieged territory. Nearly 60 Palestinians were killed in Israel's strikes on Thursday. One of the regime's attacks killed 6 civilians after a group of citizens were hit near a hospital in a Ramal neighborhood of Gaza City. Half a dozen fatalities were also reported after a house was bombed in the Ashati refugee camp west of Gaza City. Another airstrike killed at least 2 displaced Palestinians in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Meanwhile, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees said Israeli forces have killed more than 370 of its employees in Gaza since October 2023. The World Health Organization also said there have been 821 attacks on Gaza's healthcare facilities this year alone, resulting in the killing of over 1,100 health workers. The death toll from the regime's genocidal war now exceeds 65,500, with nearly 167,400 others injured. Our correspondent in Gaza, Mutia Abu Musaba, joined us earlier with the latest updates on the Israeli regime strikes across the besieged territory. Let us take a listen.
A short while ago, the Israeli warplanes launched another series of the brutal attacks against Ashar refugee camp. Dozens of the Palestinian residential buildings were reportedly destroyed and leveled to the ground. And unfortunately, many of those residential buildings were populated with the Palestinian people. So apparently, we are talking about another horrific massacre unfolding right now in Ashar refugee camp under those relentless bombardments and attacks. In the meantime, another gathering of the Palestinian people was hit and targeted in the heart of Gaza City, particularly in Ar-Rimal neighborhood. According to the initial outcomes, we are talking about 6 Palestinian civilians were confirmed killed a short while ago as a consequence of the attack. And as you know, Gaza City is still ravaged with more brutal attacks by the Israeli occupation forces amid this ongoing wide-scale invasion that targets the entire city. The Israeli occupation forces are still exercising more pressure on the Palestinian people, forcing them to evacuate and leave Gaza City to the southern parts of Gaza Strip. The current situation is abysmal and miserable for those Palestinian people, and as you know, those people are still suffering from the lack of the basic humanitarian essentials and needs. We are talking about a real and a conspicuous influx of those Palestinian families coming from Gaza City to the central area of Gaza Strip, and they are suffering from the starvation, dehydration, the lack of the basic necessities.
The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has issued a stern warning about the humanitarian situation in Gaza amid Israel's unrelenting strikes. Philippe Lazzarini said conditions in Gaza remain absolutely unbearable, describing the situation as hell in all its possible facets.
What's going on in Gaza is absolutely unbearable. We had a week ago, last week, the Commission of Inquiry, which came to its conclusion describing it as a genocide. It added, in fact, its conclusion to many other, I would say, scholars or NGOs, including Israeli NGOs, who basically concluded to the same. And it is true that Gaza today, people are experiencing hell in all its possible facets.
Addressing a press conference at the UN headquarters, Lazzarini urged the world leaders to act. He said a full classroom of children dies every hour while large amounts of food are blocked outside Gaza. He criticized the Israeli and US-backed so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, calling it a tool for political and military objectives. Lazzarini said the humanitarian system is collapsing in Gaza, calling on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to put an end to this hell. He stressed that only a political decision can stop the suffering of Palestinians in the territory and restore meaningful aid access. Pro-Palestine protesters have held a rally in the British capital London to condemn Israel's repeated attacks on the global Samud flotilla, which is en route to Gaza to break the Israeli siege of the territory. The flotilla is also taking humanitarian supplies to the besieged people of Gaza. Protesters said the repeated attacks show that Israel has no respect for the international law and the world needs to take action to stop the regime.
Well, I think it is a continuation of the Israeli policy with the Palestinian resistance, whether it be inside Palestine or outside. They're trying to shut down every support. We have a Zionist entity that's so radicalized that they are not willing to let anything pass. I also think that this initiative is very welcoming. A lot of brave people trying to break the siege on Gaza. And I think we need to support this initiative, and that's why I'm here today.
It is an attack on all of us. Any attempt to provide any help for the Palestinians, Israel's mission is to stop that. Whether it's a flotilla, whether it's a campaign in the UK, whether it's a global movement for the Palestinians, whether it's a movement of the people to ask their governments to recognize Palestine, which now the UK has, but it's just a symbolic gesture. The whole idea for Israel is to stop every single attempt to help the Palestinians in any way.
I feel so embarrassed. I feel so shocked. How can the world be silent about this? What is this ship doing? The ship is carrying humanitarian aid to the people, to the innocent people of Gaza, and this is being attacked by the Zionist Nazi drones. And where's the world to mix in? Well, thank you for Italy and for Spain for starting to do something, but we're waiting for action really.
The Yemeni army says it has conducted a fresh anti-Israel operation, hitting several sensitive targets in the occupied Jaffa region with a multiple warhead hypersonic Palestine 2 ballistic missile.
The missile force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a qualitative military operation using a multiple warheads hypersonic Palestine 2 ballistic missile, targeting several sensitive targets in the occupied Jaffa region. The operation, thanks be to Allah, successfully achieved its objectives, forcing millions of herds of usurping Zionists to flee to shelters and halting operations at Lod Airport. In another context, our air defenses, thanks be to Allah, were able to intercept a number of combat formations by launching a number of surface-to-air missiles during the recent Israeli aggression against our country, forcing some of them to leave and thwarting part of the attack. The Yemeni armed forces call on all civilian and military companies and vessels exist in the theater of operations in the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea, or transiting through them, to identify themselves and reveal their identities. Otherwise, they will be subject to targeting, and they will bear full responsibility.
Sari said the operation was carried out in response to the Israeli aggression against Yemen and its ongoing genocide in the Gaza Strip. He stressed that the Yemeni army will carry out more operations at an escalating pace in defense of the country and in support of Gaza until the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian territory ends and its siege is lifted. The new operation came after a fresh Israeli aggression targeted residential neighborhoods and civilian infrastructure in Yemen's capital Sana'a, killing at least 9 people and injuring 174 others.
The latest Israeli assault on Sana'a has left scenes of destruction and grief. A power facility struck, and surrounding homes were reduced to rubble, with residents rushing to save survivors buried beneath the debris.
An Israeli airstrike attacked a residential neighborhood. There are no military manifestations here whatsoever. Those injured are only women, children, and elderly. Netanyahu only wants to kill innocents because his military campaign against us is a failure.
At the hospital, survivors of the strike are being treated for serious injuries.
I was walking out of my home when the strike hit us. We heard loud explosions. What can I say except may Allah destroy them? So many people fell victim. Praise be to Allah, this is all for Gaza. This is nothing compared to what they are going through in Gaza.
Another patient described being crushed under fallen rubble.
When they attacked, rocks fell on top of me and broke my left side. One rock fell on me and split the back of my head open. My leg and foot were also injured, as you can see.
As Yemen reels from the latest strike, residents and the injured alike say their sacrifices are inseparable from Gaza's struggle, despite the loss of life and the destruction of civilian areas. Yemenis vow their determination will not waver.
Over the past couple of months, the Israeli airstrikes have mainly targeted civilian infrastructure and public facilities. But the Yemeni people say the attacks will not stop them from continuing to strike Tel Aviv in support of Palestine. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Iran's foreign minister has once again censured the 3 European parties to the 2015 nuclear deal for their insistence on activating the so-called snapback mechanism. Abbas Araghchi described the European Troika's move as unjustified, illegal, and irresponsible. Araghchi was speaking in a meeting with his British counterpart, Yvette Cooper. He said the European Troika has no justification for restoring previously annulled UN Security Council's resolutions. Araghchi said for a whole decade, the US and Troika tried to deprive Iranians of their inalienable rights under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. He said the approach taken to Iran by the US and the 3 European countries following Washington's recent attacks on Iranian nuclear sites was betrayal of both diplomacy and the non-proliferation regime. Iran's top diplomat stressed that the Troika's decision to activate the snapback mechanism is in line with the U.S. administration's inhuman policy of mounting maximum pressure on Iran. He emphasized that the Iranian nation will never submit to military attack nor diplomatic pressure and will continue to maintain its independence and dignity. Political commentator Paul Laridi says there is not much logic in the West's insistence on triggering the snapback mechanism, and it's impossible for Iran to satisfy the European parties and their allies.
They didn't destroy Iran, and so they have to do what in their view is the next best thing. It's really impossible to satisfy Israel and its NATO partners, including the United States as well. And it's the problem is that Iran is not obeying the commands of the European nations and the United States. So it has nothing to do with whether it makes sense, whether it's logical, or whether it's in accord with the understandings, or whether they benefit from it. They want to, I don't know, teach a lesson to other countries that they have to listen to what the West decides must be done.
The city of Kargil, the capital of the Himalayan region of Ladakh in India, has observed a complete shutdown a day after clashes between police and protesters left several people dead. The demonstrators were demanding statehood for the federal territory, said Ali Safi reports from Kargil with the latest on the unrest.
Tensions are running high in India's Himalayan region of Ladakh after a statehood protest in Leh turned violent. leaving at least 4 people dead and around 80 injured, including security personnel. Authorities imposed curfew in parts of Ladakh amid ongoing unrest. While tensions persisted in Leh, shops and businesses stayed shut across Kargil on Thursday.
Life in Kargil has come to a grinding halt, with the border town observing a complete shutdown to protest Wednesday's police firing and to show solidarity with the people of Leh.
The Kargil Democratic Alliance, which has long been demanding statehood and safeguards for Ladakh, called the shutdown. Authorities banned gatherings and deployed security forces to patrol empty streets to maintain law and order. People in Kargil have called for a judicial inquiry into the killing of protesters and demand action against those who gave the orders. India's Federal Home Ministry has accused activist Sonam Wangchuk of inciting violence by making provocative statements. Wangchuk ended his hunger strike on its 15th day, shortly after unrest broke out on Wednesday. In a press statement, the Home Ministry has said it is in active talks with apex body Leh and Kargil Democratic Alliance to address public concerns. The Ladakh region bordering China and Pakistan became a separate union territory in August 2019, after New Delhi scrapped Kashmir's semi-autonomous status and split the erstwhile state of Jammu and Kashmir into two federal territories. The ruling BJP has accused Congress of inciting violence for political gain, while Congress blames the unrest on the central government's, quote, broken promises and inaction. As the situation remains tense, all eyes are now on New Delhi, with hopes for peaceful and negotiated resolution. Sidri Safi, Ladakh.
And that is a wrap for this hour's news bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us.
Diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
For millennia, Iranian scholars have actively contributed to advancing knowledge in science and technology. And today, Iran is part of the fast pace at which technological innovation is developing using knowledge-based research. Energy-efficient light bulbs or COVID-19 testing kits are just some of the knowledge-based products that you might be familiar with. Iranian knowledge-based companies have brought many social and economic advantages for people and generating billions of dollars in revenues from its product.
Oh, hello. Welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the weekly show that looks at profits, markets, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. Today's program will focus on how advanced technologies are created. We wanted to see how an idea can be transformed into a marketable, specialized product and how we'll uncover how they have contributed to the economy. Enough said. Let's walk through today's Bazaar.
Our journey began at a company that works closely with the Islamic Azad University of Iran. Virajin Akam was first established in 2008 and specializes in making technology for analyzing genes and viruses. Its main products are panel H kits and devices used in medical laboratories. Currently, it has commercialized two of its products for virus detection tests. As part of its vision for the future, this knowledge-based company is looking to expand its product list to include molecular analysis kits for cancer cells. The production unit incorporates the latest technology while including the highest quality of raw material. This company uses in-depth scientific research and know-how, which is carried out by expert staff to manufacture its high-tech products. It has received its production licenses from the Ministry of Health and Medical Education and obtained international standardization certifications too. This means its products, while matching national standards, also adhere to international regulations allowing them to easily compete in global markets. This company produces 20 different types of kits and a variety of diagnostic kits as well. The production facilities are capable of producing thousands of testing kits per week. There are numerous opportunities for investment in such a company, particularly as it is already standing on the threshold of exporting its products.
As you might know, medical testing kits are very sensitive items which need to be dependable and accurate. Their continuous accuracy is the most important aspect of their use. A lot of science and research goes into making these products, which are the tools doctors use to help patients. For this reason, quality assurance is key in being able to market these items.
The heart of this company is its highly equipped quality control division. Here, all products are tested for performance and accuracy in each stage of production. This includes testing the raw material used to make these kits. This department is essential for maintaining quality and manufacturing items with zero failure rates. But that's not all. The quality control unit is also home to the research and development department. One of the activities at this department is to reverse engineer certain items, such as kits used for the study of genetics, which are currently imported. One of the competitive advantages of this company is that it manufactures medical devices that were previously imported. Indigenizing these items has saved the medical sector millions of dollars from capital flight. Another advantage of this knowledge-based company is its link to the Islamic Azad University's Technology Development Center, meaning the research and development division of this company is able to directly benefit from scientific advancements and services provided by the academic institution. This company has faced numerous challenges over the years, but its trump card has always been its uniquely progressive approach to development. The US sanctions have marginally impacted businesses in this field by hampering international money transfers. This knowledge-based company views the sanctions as an opportunity to strengthen productions, filling the market void while reducing the country's dependence on imports.
Research driven by scientific inquiry plays a significant role in product development. At its core, advanced technology is created by adding valuable features to items that have specialized uses. Academic and research institutions are the bridge between ideas and marketable products, and several universities across Iran are providing services to help support knowledge-based startups.
The company we discussed earlier is an example of a knowledge-based company that was born from the support of a growth program at the Islamic Azad University. The program is called Roshd Center, and its main activity is to incubate startups and entrepreneurship. The center is a platform that supports the creation and developments of new businesses in the field of advanced technology development as they start up. It provides services to entrepreneurial teams to successfully implement their ideas and help them compete in national and global markets. These services include offering workspace facilities and managerial, technical, and legal consultations. Usually, startups are incubated at this center for around 3 to 5 years. These centers serve as a type of technical infrastructure and offer a framework for sustainable business growth. The incubators also pursue broader goals, such as regional economic growth, and diversify the economy and investors. It also provides assistance to women and society's minorities in their entrepreneurial endeavors. The advantage of a university incubator is its upfront link to live research and the most recent discoveries. It is a place where scientific advancement directly meets technology development. Azad universities have some 400 campuses nationwide and hundreds of thousands of students enrolling annually. Each campus is equipped with a Roshd Center. For example, the North Tehran unit has 22 projects currently incubating.
But universities aren't the only place where incubators are found. Science and technology parks are also another area that offer similar services to knowledge-based startup and technology-developing businesses. Many of their products are presently streamlined into the market and are also exported to destination markets abroad.
Tech parks are another place where advanced technology is developed for various industries. Based on figures from the Ministry of Research, Science and Technology, there are 42 tech parks and 186 incubators spread across the country. The number of knowledge-based companies has steadily increased over the years. If there were 50 high-tech firms in 2013, now there are 125 times more than that number in 2021. Right now, there are over 6,200 high-tech firms and knowledge-based companies nationwide. Many of these businesses are active in the field of information and communication technology, machinery equipment, and electronic products. Plus, a large number of the companies are actively producing medical devices and pharmaceuticals. Last year, tech and knowledge-based firms raked in over $5 billion in internal revenues. That's according to statistics from Iran's National Innovation Fund. The Science and Technology Office of the Vice Presidency estimates exports of these products will generate $1 billion in foreign revenues by the end of the year. High technology is a product of advancements in national academic and scientific research. And nearly 70,000 academic articles were published in 2020 alone to show for it. Data from the International Web of Science shows Iran was globally ranked as 16th in 2019 for its citation work. All things considered, Iran's tech ecosystem is flourishing. Several industries have benefited from indigenized technology that has facilitated big advancements productions.
Okay, it's time for me to take a short break and pass the action over to my good friend and colleague out there on the field. So, take it away.
A general classification divides enterprises into two distinct categories. The first is labor-intensive enterprises, and the second is knowledge-intensive enterprises. I'm sure that you're familiar with the former, but the latter is primarily concerned with problem-solving, research and development, creativity, and it heavily relies on intellectual skills. Where I'm standing right now is a hub for knowledge-intensive enterprises in Iran. Pardis Technology Park is home to more than 270 companies, including SMEs, small and medium-sized startups, and large companies. Some of them have already introduced valuable and essential products to the market, whereas the others are still in their burgeoning phases and are clawing their way up. And this place acts as an incubator for them. This tech park is one of the largest of its kind in the region, and was built in an effort to reduce the cost of importing knowledge and provide professional support for creativity and innovation. And I'm going to tell you this, the result has been phenomenal. In this week's feature program, we're going to learn more about Pardis Technology Park.
Pardis Technology Park is located in an area measuring almost 60 hectares, which is expandable to 1,000 hectares, and is situated 20 kilometers northeast of Tehran. It's under the auspices of the Vice Presidency for Science and Technology and a 14-entity board of trustees comprising of corporate and real bodies from ministries, science centres and academies, headed by the first Vice President of the country. Its objectives are many-fold, but they are all directed towards the growth and development of the economy of Iran. It's set to commercialise the research results and establish sustainable ties between universities and industries, creating synergy between private and state sectors, just to name a few.
When a group of people come to each other and meet each other and make a team, so they need some ambient to help them to grow. At the same time, they need some mentors, some financial aids, and so many things. They need to be a kind of environment to help them to grow. That's why this building and this park is also called a kind of growing system, growing ecosystem.
PTP is considered the most pioneering and advanced and largest technology park in Iran, and it's well distinguished by many reputed foreign and domestic organizations, The technology park has great potentials to turn into a major centre for economic, research and scientific activities. It also meets the requirements for linking to actual and potential global markets, and its wide-ranging activities have so far been successful.
The park is not limited to knowledge-intensive companies, but also houses and assists technology companies by definition. There are different buildings here, and in order to construct new buildings, some certain standards have to be met. There's a board of architectural design that observes and makes sure that each building has unique and creative architectural elements. This is done to make the park visually attractive. Different events are held annually at this place, during which new ideas that are worthy of being marketed, new findings of the research done by the companies that are based in this place, and also new products are presented.
We are manufacturing the anesthesia machine with ventilator, which has been created after 7 years of R&D in our company, and it's about 2 years we have provided this unit to the medical centers. Actually, this unit used to be imported from abroad, and by having our production in the medical centers, the hospitals, of course, we are fully providing this product and no need to import anymore.
I, for one, was amazed to learn how wide the scale of scientific and technological achievements of the park have been so far, and couldn't help but take pride in Iran's technological prowess. Let's meet another pioneer.
Yeah, this is called the knowledge-based company because we created a company called Ziztakhmir, which is a pioneer in probiotic industry in Iran. We make the initial effort around 20 years back in the University of Tehran. We established an R&D-based facility there, and after 5 years, we managed to establish a company and started to produce supplements, probiotic supplements, which were very new at that time.
Companies and their research and development centers should subscribe to one of the areas specified and supported by the park. These include, but are not limited to, telecommunication, biotechnology, nanotechnology, pharmaceutical materials, and more. Last year, according to reports, this park exported 50 of its products to 22 countries, and its export value amounted to 27 million euros. And so Paradis Technology Park proved itself as an important asset to the country's economic apparatus to help it fight the deleterious effects of draconian sanctions imposed on Iran.
PTP has its own rather unique way to acknowledge the contribution of international scientists who at some point have added something to the park, and that is sculpting their busts. These sculptures, which are spread across the park, give it a museum-like touch, and of course for visitors, it's both informative and entertaining. PTP appears to have been an interesting technology hub for people outside of Iran too. Many ambassadors, politicians, ministers, and scientific figures have visited PTP so far.
What you saw in this report was only a small part of the first phase of this large complex, which is called Innovation Paradise. There are going to be some other parts added to this large complex. The second phase is called Health Paradise, and the third phase is called Entrepreneurship Paradise. According to the expansion plan of the park, the complex will eventually measure up to 1,000 hectares, and that will make it the most important technology zone in West Asia. The contribution of these hubs to the overall economic growth of the country is an indicative of their importance in identifying and presenting the country's technological capabilities, and of course, in accelerating its growth. And maybe this large plane over there is a symbol of that.
Well, that covers our program for today. Take care, everyone. I'm Samson Zees. Sees you in the next Bazaar.
something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. I wish that somehow you tell me out aloud that on that day I'll be okay. But we'll never know, 'cause that's not the way it works. Help me find my way. My Lord, show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long, make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long, make me strong. I know I'm waiting, yearning for something, something known only to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Life is one mystery. That somehow you tell me out of love that on that day you'll forgive me. But we'll never know, 'cause that's not the way it works. I beg for your mercy. Show me right from wrong. Give me light, make me strong. I know the road is long, make me strong. Sometimes it just gets too much. I feel that I've lost touch. I know the road is long, make me strong.
Kerman is counted as one of the oldest cities, and it was founded as a defensive outpost with the name Veh Ardashir by Ardashir I, founder of the Sasanid Empire, in the 3rd century AD. Kerman was ruled by Turkmens, Arabs, and Mongols after the 7th century, and
and was expanded rapidly during the Safavid dynasty. When Marco Polo visited Kerman in 1271, it had become a major trade center linking the Persian Gulf with Khorasan and Central Asia. Ganjadi Khan was the governor of Kerman during the Safavid era. He ruled thousands of cities and towns from Fars province all the way to the city of Herat in today's Afghanistan. During his time, he built lots of public places in the city of Kerman, including this huge square, bazaar, mosque, and a public bath. Kerman's Jame, or Central Mosque, is a part of the Muzaffari aggregate and was completed in 1345 AD by Amir Mubarizuddin Muhammad Muzaffari Meybudi Yazdi. The mosque is one of the most ancient structures of the country and a remnant of the Iranian monarchs after the Alibuye dynasty. The mosque has a tall gateway in its eastern sector, and the same has been decorated with beautiful tile work. A clock tower aids in the enhancement of this entrance. The structure has been constructed in a symmetrical fashion and has a winter and summer porch. Walking through dark and narrow halls to enter a huge and lighted area is a style in Islamic architecture of the Safavid era to give you the sense of joy and pleasure of entering a place like a public bath, which was not only for personal sanitation, but also for socializing, with people coming, sitting down, smoking hookah and pipe, and talking about social and political issues, or even finding husbands and wives for their kids, back in the old days style. Built in the Safavid period, this courtyard is home to what was once Kerman's most important hammam or bathhouse, the Hammam Ganjali Khan, now restored and transformed into a museum. With the conversion of the population of Iran to Islam, ritual purity through washing one's body became a requirement of religious life. Thenceforth, bathing became an integral part of life. Besides, baths were frequented not only for purity and hygienic reasons, but also for medical purposes. Physicians prescribed taking the waters against a great variety of ailments. Whenever I get a chance to travel to different cities of this beautiful land of Iran, I definitely stop by the bazaar of that city. Not just for shopping, but for the whole experience. Experience of meeting people from different backgrounds, with different ethnicities, different ages, different dialects, and so on. Another part of this experience is the pleasant scent of the bazaar. Smells of colorful and different spices, dried fruits, and even dried dairy products. It's just amazing. A review of Iran's economic and social history indicates that the bazaar has always been a pillar of civic foundations. No town could survive without the bazaar, whether big or small. Some have allegorically described bazaar as the economic heartbeat of the Iranian cities. The ancient Iranian bazaars have gradually evolved into an encompassing section of the town. A bazaar was not a secluded section of the town, but home to a wide spectrum of goods and services sought by the townspeople. Archaeologists could find proofs of the existence of a 6,000-year-old bazaar in a place called Khabis near Kerman, a place which is now called Shahdad. I know you definitely want to know more about Kerman, and I'm not finished exploring this city. So we'll see you soon in the next program about some other attractions of Kerman. Shahryar Azimi for Iran. We'll be right back.
heard the boastful Persian saying that art only belongs to Iranians. With their wide variety in color and patterns, and each motif and design specific to a particular region, Persian carpets are definitely something to boast about. In Iran, carpets have always been both symbolic and practical. A popular design that is often used in this region is called Rizmahi, which means the little fish. Quality craftsmanship is the name of the game, and the painstaking procedure of knotting, invented by ancient Persians, is a means to reflect a people's identity. It may take a group of up to 15 carpet weavers nearly a year to create the masterpieces that will be decorating the floors, giving any room warmth and style. Iranians are definitely the masters of weaving. Jajim, which is a kind of thick two-sided cloth, itself can be considered enough evidence to support the boastful statement that art only belongs to Iranians. There was a time when jajim was considered a luxury item, but today it's used for making traditional handbags, something you can take back home as a souvenir from Iran. Jajim is normally 2.5 meters long and 2 meters wide. And although its patterns may vary, the simpler and more common jajim includes stripes 1 to 5 centimeters wide of different colors. Sometimes to create a checkered pattern, colorful wraps are used. Traditionally, though, jajim is woven on a horizontal loom with colorful fine threads of wool and usually by a single weaver. Both sides of the jajim can be used, which is why it has become a multi-purpose article, often quilted and used as a cover or blanket, and sometimes even spread on the ground. The taste and talent of these people can also be seen through the designs of their earthenware. Pottery is perhaps the earliest and most important invention of mankind in Iran, dating back to the 7th millennium BC. In the small town of Khusf, not much has changed since the invention of the potter's wheel. Symmetry is omnipresent in Persian craftsmanship. The detailed patterns of the 7,000-year-old art of marquetry are no exception. When it comes to decorating your home traditionally, wooden lattice doors and windows with stained glass are things you simply can't miss. The number of wooden pieces needed for each door is striking. It is usually beechwood or sycamore that is considered the best for refined carving at this level. Woodwork like this dates back at least 1,500 years. Some historians say it even dates back to the Sassanid era. So I guess we have to admit that there's at least a little bit something to the Persian old saying that art only belongs to Iranians. Gisu Misha Ahmadi for Iran.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to you all. You are tuning to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. I'm your presenter for the next hour. We'll start off this hour's programs with Round the World with Reporters. Reporters from all over the globe tells us what is happening in their corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from distant lands. That will be followed by Hadith of the Day. The program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. Our radio production's feature will be the next. And our final program this hour is The Last Savior. This program discusses the occultation of Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. Everything about his government and his life. Stay with us for the next hour.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The assembly will hear.
While presidents and leaders took the podium during the UNGA high-level week in New York, activists and demonstrators protested the UNGA debates as the people of Gaza continue to be ethnically cleansed by the Israeli occupation and the world remains watching. Banners condemning the UN's negligence towards preserving international law were held high among the crowd, alongside the complicity of the U.S. in the forced starvation of the Palestinian people and the sale of weapons to the occupation killing the Palestinians.
After 2 years of genocide, most of the world has come to realize that it is in fact a genocide, except the United States and Israel, of course. And the U.S. is, Trump is speaking today, which is a mockery of anything.
The protest today at the UN is mostly about the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu is down here and there's going to be talks about how Israel and the U.S. are going to respond, which is most likely going to lead to full annexation of the West Bank. We are also protesting the fact that multiple states or multiple countries have now recognized a Palestinian state, which, while it is one step forward, is not full liberation. You know, you can't recognize that the knife is there without fully pulling it out and healing the wound.
As world leaders gather at the UN headquarters here in New York to discuss various issues, the urgency of Gaza's situation is highlighted by protesters surrounding the building. These protesters are demanding the protection of Palestinians. They are demanding the end of the Gaza siege and the liberation of Palestine.
Demonstrators also criticize the double standards and selective protection that the international body stands for when it comes to preaching about women's rights, but Palestine is often overlooked.
What kind of values do you stand for? Like you just said, there's pregnant women, there's babies being killed, there's no access to menstrual supplies. How can you be human if you're not letting these, if not letting aid in, not stopping the occupation? It's ridiculous.
It's all of our rights. It's women's rights, it's children's rights, it's human rights, it's really planet rights. Like, we're, by not protecting one community of people, we're really not protecting any of us, because it's a chain reaction, and when you fail to protect someone, you're really failing to protect yourself, and I think they have to remember that.
More protests are planned to occur for the length of the high-level week, calling for the freedom of Palestine from occupation and the preservation of the Palestinian identity. Rachel Hamdouin, New York.
Efforts at the international level to recognize and support a Palestinian state have been ongoing for the past 5 decades. These efforts have speeded up in recent weeks as Israel's intensified war on Gaza has prompted more countries to recognize Palestinian statehood.
These recognitions are the result of the blood of our sons and daughters in Gaza, their sacrifices, and the genocide taking place there. They would not have happened without the continuous struggle of our people.
Palestinians say the recognition alone is not enough. Without real international measures to bring an end to their suffering caused by Israel's occupation of their land.
Recognition must empower the Palestinian people to realize sovereignty and full national independence. Israel's membership in international bodies must be suspended, and concrete actions must be imposed to hold the occupying regime criminally accountable.
International acts of recognition of Palestine are seen by many as long overdue, but Palestinians insist these steps must be understood against backdrop of genocide in Gaza and the continuing struggle of thousands of prisoners.
Sadly, the world has shut its eyes and ears to the massacre in Gaza. It demands the release of 45 captives while ignoring tens of thousands of our prisoners, including my son. These double standards must end. The recognition comes in a natural context. Palestine has always existed, with or without recognition, and it will endure through the steadfastness and resistance of its people.
In 1974, the UN General Assembly granted the Palestinian Liberation Organization observer status. That was followed by the symbolic declaration of Palestinian statehood in Algeria in 1988. And in 2012, 138 countries recognized Palestine as an observer state of the UN General Assembly. Similar measures were taken in the years afterwards. Analysts, however, say the real priority today is not more declarations, but halting the genocide, ensuring accountability, and strengthening Palestinian resilience. What Palestinians need today is not more ceremonies or declarations, but a strategy that connects their sacrifices to real accountability, unity, and protection under international law. Recognition alone will not stop genocide or displacement. Naqa Hamid, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
Outside the Palestinian mission in London, history in the making. The iconic Palestinian flag raised, preceded by an impassioned speech by the country's ambassador, flanked by British politicians.
This moment is not only about Palestine. It is also about Britain and the British government's solemn responsibility. It is about ending the denial of the Palestinian people's inalienable right to freedom and self-determination. And it is an acknowledgement of a historic injustice.
The ceremony follows the UK's recognition of Palestine as a state, aligning Britain with more than 140 countries worldwide.
This is now officially the Palestinian embassy in London, the country's flag atop this pole for the first time since the UK's recognition of the country. It is a symbolic but powerful moment, the participants here say, one that affirms a nation's struggle for self-determination that has gone on for far too long.
But beyond symbolism, questions remain. With the genocide in Gaza ongoing, the West Bank under occupation, and Britain's continued arms sales to Israel, does recognition mean anything?
British government recognizes Palestine carries with it responsibilities. Responsibility not to supply arms to Israel. Responsibilities not to share military information with Israel. And a demand, which we will be intensively making, for full economic sanctions against Israel, including all trade embargoes, until the occupation ends.
In the run-up to the recognition announcement, a YouGov poll found less than half of Britons saying recognition was a good idea, while only 18% disagreed.
I can understand the skepticism and cynicism with the history of this whole area. So I can understand that completely. My role as a parliamentarian and the people that I represent, and which are the good people of this country and millions of them, will now ensure that they utilize this position to take it to the next step.
At the same time, there are other voices in Britain, like those at this debate in Birmingham, who say while recognition was long overdue, the only way forward is one state, not two.
The two-state proposition is clearly a Zionist talking point. It's designed to kick the can down the road, to continually kick the can down the road, to never, ever be in a situation where such a notion could ever be brought into existence.
For supporters here, today is about hope, solidarity, and international legitimacy. For Palestinians under bombardment, it's a reminder that recognition alone is not liberation. Saeed Pourreza, London.
On Monday, hundreds of thousands of people flooded the streets of tens of Italian cities to express their solidarity with the Palestinians who have been